hear me back there all right? Is that too loud? How's that? Thank you. I'm Charles Keim from the College of Arts and Letters. I almost changed the program here at the last minute because as we were bringing Mr. Pierre Burton, our distinguished guest this evening, to the Great Hall, I was telling him about an old chum of mine and a good friend of university, Gilbert Thompson, who has told me for quite a number of years that he was conceived in Eagle and born in Dawson because that was the custom of the times. And as we were driving to the campus, I talked a little bit about Gilbert, who has been all over Alaska, has collected all sorts of things for the University of Alaska Museum, and naturally he walked in with the director of the museum, Professor Ludwig Browinski. But as I introduced him to Pierre Burton, they started talking, and I was wishing that we could put them on kind of a panel discussion because they were reliving their old days in Dawson and Eagle along the Yukon River. Gilbert, I wonder if you'd just stand for a moment so some of your many friends can see you. This is Gilbert Thompson. Then I thought perhaps I'd have Gilbert introduce our guest, but since I prepared the introduction, I think I'll do that myself. But strangely, it does bring Gilbert Thompson back into the picture again, because on May 30th, 1962, I received a book titled Klondike by Pierre Burton, The Life and Death of the Last Great Gold Rush. And inscribed in it, it says, May 30th, 1962, Dawson, Yukon Territory, Canada. Chuck, you may thank Pierre for the writing below, and even more for such a well-written book. And then he signed it, and it's also inscribed by Mr. Burton. So thank you, Mr. Burton, 8 years later for your very fine book. Alaskans generally concede that this is the best book ever written about the last great gold rush. It's also one of the finest books, historians will say, of the North Country. Our guest this evening is a distinguished author, editor, broadcaster, and television personality, and to introduce him almost requires a book, or at least a story. He's perhaps the best known in all categories in Canada, and we deeply appreciate him here in Alaska, too. He works in all branches of communication. He has written review sketches for the stage, documentaries for films and TV, a daily newspaper column, and 15 books, many of them internationally known. He's seen 5 nights a week on Canadian independent television stations on his own half-hour conversation program, The Pierre Burton Show, and once a week on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's top-rated panel show, Front Page Challenge, now in its 10th year. Added to this, he's editorial director of the Illustrated Book Division of McClellan and Stewart, Canada's largest book publisher. A few highlights from his career thus far, and I say thus far because this evening he informed me he's in the middle of a 2-volume book on the Canadian Pacific Railroad. At 21, he was the youngest city editor on any Canadian daily newspaper. That was the News Herald in Vancouver. Naturally, the Festival of Arts, and particularly the Department of Journalism and the Department of English, wanted to bring him here for that reason among many. At 31, 10 years later, he was the managing editor of Canada's largest magazine, Maclean's. He's the only Canadian newspaper man to win 2 national newspaper awards in 1 year for staff corresponding and feature writing. He's one of the few Canadian authors to win 2 Governor General's awards for creative nonfiction for his books, The Mysterious North and Klondike. His film, City of Gold, is especially well known to Alaska. We have it here on campus. It's shown regularly and all over Alaska. This is a documentary about the Klondike Gold Rush for which he wrote and read the narration, and it has won more than 30 awards, including the Grand Prix at Cannes. Other awards include the Laycock Medal for Humor for his satirical book, Just Add Water and Stir, and the J.V. McCary Award for Columnist of the Year, 1960. One book, The Comfortable Pew, A Critical Examination of the Major Protestant Churches, broke all existing Canadian book publishing sales records. As I said, Mr. Burton and Mr. Thompson have been reliving their days along the Yukon. He was born in the Yukon and spent the first 12 years of his life in Dawson City, in the Klondike, to which his father had made his way during the Great Stampede of 1898. Later, he worked for 3 years in Klondike mining camps to put himself through University of British Columbia, from which he was graduated in 1941. He became city editor of the Vancouver News Herald almost immediately, joined the Army as a private in 1942, rose to captain instructor at the Royal Military College at Kingston, and resumed his newspaper career on the Vancouver Sun in 1945. He joined Maclean's magazine in 1947 and left as managing editor to join the Toronto Star in 1958. He was named associate editor of the Star and wrote a widely read daily column until 1962. He has worked in Canadian radio and TV since 1946. In 1963, his probing and conversational and interview program was launched. It's now in its seventh season. The program appears nightly on the independent Canadian television station and is produced by Screen Gems Canada Limited. The story goes on and on and on. And this evening, as I asked him for some words of wisdom to pass along to my writing classes, I said, "What kind of a regimen do you set for yourself?" And he said, "Well, no particular regimen." He said, "I just write." He said, "You know, very few things are written by just talking." And one of my best professors told me that once, Mr. Burton. He said, "It isn't what you say that counts, it's what you do." Mr. Burton is a doer, and that's why we respect him so highly in Alaska, and we're so appreciative that he's here for the Festival of Arts this year. Mr. Burton.
Dean Kime, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to be back in Alaska. It's a state that I don't know as well as I know the neighboring territory of the Yukon. And the part that I do know is the Panhandle, which is quite a long way from here. I used to travel up and down the Alaska coast, as I was telling Mr. Thompson, and Skagway and Wrangell and Ketchikan, Sitka and Juneau are all very familiar to me. This is only my second time in Fairbanks. Last time I was in Alaska was in 1962, and I had all my family with me. We came up the Alaska Highway to the Gold Rush Festival, and we came across the border because I wanted to go over the 60-mile trail, which starts on this side and goes across to Dawson City, and one of the most beautiful drives, I think, in the world. I have 7 kids now, and I only had 6 then. One of them was only 2 months old, which meant that we had to take a playpen and everything else. I remember that I said, my wife packed a Coleman lamp. I said, "What are you putting that in for?" She said, "That's so we can see at night. The kids may want to get up and go to the toilet." And I said, "Well, they won't need that." She said, "Well, of course they'll need that." I said, "It's light all night." She said, "Oh, don't give me that light all night stuff." I said, "You'll find out. Pack the Coleman lamp. You'll never take it out of the box." And she never did, of course. The first time that I was ever in Alaska, I was only 7 years old. It was an excursion on the old steamer Yukon, a stern wheeler, from Dawson City to 40 Mile, the old mining camp that predates all the others, which was even then just a series of rotting cabins. It's on the Canadian side, as you know, but the steamer went across the American side and was quite a thrill for us all to enter the fabulous United States, which I'd heard of for so many years and never seen. It seemed exactly the same as the other side when I got there. The reason we'd heard of the United States so often and Alaska so often was that most of our mail was addressed to the Burton family, Dawson City, Yukon Territory, Alaska, which used to enrage my father, who was a staunch Canadian and an old sourdough, and he never got over this, nor did he ever get over the fact that when we went to the outside, people were always confusing Alaska and the Yukon. And I suppose I've, to this day, never quite got over people telling me in the United States, not in Alaska, but if you go down to California, or even New York, and certainly any farther south, they will insist to me that the Klondike River is in Alaska. And even if I tell them that I was raised on the banks of the Klondike River and fished in it and walked across it and fell in it and everything else, there is no way I can convince many Americans that really the Klondike Gold Rush, which was in many ways an American gold rush, actually took place at its ultimate stage on Canadian soil, which is one of the most interesting things about it. When that book that you saw was published, a television outfit in the United States purchased the rights for a television series. And this confusion continued to exist. They paid me a fairly substantial sum of money as an advisor on the series, and never asked my advice. But one day I was in New York on business, and so I thought I'd go up to see the company to see how the series was coming along. And they were very pleasant people. They welcomed me, and I went up there. And I said, how is the series coming? Oh, he said, it's coming pretty good. We're very pleased. We'll go into production next spring with it. And I said, I presume that you've got a central character for the series, because that's what a television series needs. In the book, it has many characters, but no central character. He said, yes, we have. I said, well, who is it? He said, well, we have this U.S. Marshal type. And I said, well, how can you have a U.S. Marshal? Because I said, this all took place on Canadian soil. No, he said, it's not a U.S. Marshal, it's a U.S. Marshal type. He said, we know what took place in Canadian soil. He said, actually, I haven't read the book. But he said, I know what it's about. I said, that's nice. He said, what does the U.S. Marshal type do in Dawson City? He said, well, there's this lawlessness there, and looting and shooting, and the miners get together, and they ask this Yank to save them from the looters and the shooters. And I said, well, maybe, I don't know, somebody should read the book. I said, because the... I better break it to you now that nobody can read that book, he said, because we have to do a script a week. And he said, it takes a week to read the book. He said, the scriptwriters can't afford to read the book. He said, the director will read the book when the time comes, and he will tell the scriptwriters what's in it. I said, well, you should know there's one thing in it, and that's that there was 40 members of the Northwest Mounted Police in Dawson keeping the law, and 200 armed militiamen, who I said might make part of the series. They tramped up the center of B.C. during fearful privations to get there in full kit with guns on their shoulders. And I said, that made 240 uniformed people keeping the law. And I said, there wasn't a single murder in Dawson in 1898 or a case of major theft. His face fell. He said, no murder. I said, no. And no theft. He said, we'll have to move the location. To the American side. And that's exactly what they did. The whole story was set in Skagway. It was called Klondike, but they really should have called it Skagway. Oh, he said, when are you shooting this? He said, we're shooting it next spring. He said, it's going to be a mud picture. I said, well, what do you mean by that? He said, that snow is no good. He said, those cornflakes never look like real snow. He said, you know, Southern California. He said, there was a lot of mud up there, wasn't there? I said, yes, in the spring there was certainly a lot of mud. He said, well, we've got the back lot of the studio and we're bringing in 7,000 tons of mud. So some time passed, and I went, that spring, I was in Los Angeles covering the Democratic National Convention, which seems exciting in retrospect because it was the one at which John F. Kennedy was nominated, but it was quite a dull convention because he had it in the bag. And about the third or fourth day, I got tired of it, and I wondered what I was going to do besides going to Disneyland, and I suddenly realized that they were making my book into a TV series just around the corner in Hollywood, and that I was being paid $300 every week as an advisor, and nobody asked my advice. So being very brash, I picked up the phone and found the Ziv television company and phoned in and said, got the producer, and I said, I'm Pierre Burton, and you're making my book, Klondike. He said, you're Pierre Burton? He said, you here? I said, yeah. He said, do you think you could get out for just an hour to help us? I said, an hour? I said, it says in my contract I'm supposed to be there for 13 weeks. I've never read that contract. And I said, have you read the book? He said, no, there isn't time to read the book. He said, but you can help us, he said. You can tell us what's in the book. So I went out there. And there's quite a crowd of people, all wearing those white kind of denims they wear, and those sort of soft sneakers and bush shirts, because they're making a Klondike picture. They're all dressed like miners. And they brought a secretary in with reams of paper and tape recorder, and they said, now sit down. I said, tell us about it. And I said, well, you've asked me questions. And they said, okay. And they said, now, what we want to do is make this thing accurate in every detail. We want really to get the feel, the smell of the North. They said, now, tell us about the foliage. What kind of trees grow up there? I said, well, birch and aspen are the two major deciduous trees, and a spruce tree is the major conifer. There's a sort of a horrible pause. The guy said, any pines and oaks? I said, no, that's too far north for either pines or oaks. There's pines around Whiters, but no oaks at all. I said, no pines and oaks, eh? I said, no. I said, all we got in Southern California is pines and oaks. I'm afraid we're going to have to go with pines and oaks. Then he said, well, what do the guys look like? I said, well, you know, that was the 90s. And they all had either beards or these huge, interesting mustaches. Oh, the guy said, they're all going to have to be clean-shaven. He said, we can't go with mustaches. That's horrible. He said, no. Well, he said, that's what a little tiny detail will deviate from. Then he said, what do they smoke? I said, well, in those days, of course, it was pipes and cigars. I said, you know, everybody was, you treated in the major saloons, everybody bought a drink. If a guy didn't drink, he took a cigar. Otherwise, on the trail, he'd smoke a pipe. He said, how about cigarettes? I said, no, there's only Sweet Caps then, and that's about all. There weren't any. He said, we've got a cigarette sponsor, and they'll be smoking cigarettes in this one, I'll tell you that. And he said, what are the saloons like? I said, well, they're full of smoke, if that's what you... No, not too much, he said. The cigarette sponsor doesn't want to overdo it. Then he said, well, give me some incidents. Tell us about the kind of people that went there. Well, I said, now, this is interesting. I said, there are people from all over the world who climbed that fantastic Chilkoot Pass. I said, there are Kanakas from Hawaii. And I said, there was even a group of Maoris from New Zealand. And instead of putting up shacks or tents, they actually made little huts of wattles. I said, you could make almost use that as the basis of one of your shows. He said, Maoris? I said, yeah. He said, they're black, aren't they? I said, well, they're kind of brown. He said, no, the sponsor won't have a single black man in this show. Well, by that time, I was getting a little sad about it all. But then I said, then the guy said, I said, what's the setting? And he told me it was going to be Skagway because that's where the rough stuff was. And I said, there's one, I said, what, he said, the mud will work, won't it? I said, if it's spring and early summer, it'll work. Yeah, it won't work in the winter because it's covered with snow. He said, well, we can't afford snow. He said, the cornflakes, they look awful. He said, nobody believes that anymore. He said, we can't have real snow, so we're going to have mud. He said, we're bringing 7,000 tons of mud. He said, we can only have it in for 5 days, and we got to get it out because they're bringing a southern western in next. There's no mud there. It's all dry. So I don't know how they do this. Apparently, they bring truckloads of mud in, and guys shovel it out again. But I said, I said that's interesting, because if it's in the spring and the summer, then you can make a lot of about the fact that it's light all night. He said, light all night? I said, yeah, you know, the sun goes down, but it's still light at midnight. And above the Arctic Circle, of course, the sun stays up. He said, but it gets dark around 10 o'clock, doesn't it? I said, not in the time when there's mud. He said, who's going to believe that nonsense? He said, they won't go for that. Besides, he said, how can we have anybody escape under cover of darkness? I said, well, you might make something out of the fact they couldn't escape under cover of darkness. Maybe you could have a guy who thinks it's going to get dark and it doesn't. It's a great show, he said. He said, well, that's a little far out. He said, besides, the sets are so cheap, we've got to hide them with darkness. They made the series. It was called Klondike. It started among other... James Coburn played Sophie Smith. He was the only good thing in it. It lasted exactly 20 episodes, and then they changed the title. They kept the same cast. They changed the title and locale, and they called it Acapulco. And I was in the office of Screen Gems, which employs me in Canada, about 3 or 4 months later, and talking to the president, who knows a lot about the motion picture business. And I told him about this. He said, a snow picture? He said, snow pictures don't go. He said, do you know what the public wants? Do you know what the public wants? They don't want snow. He said, do you know what they want? I said, no. He said, I'll tell you what they want. Tits and sand, he said. That's what they want. Tits and sand. So that ended my association with Hollywood and the Klondike. And I regret to say that, as I'm sure most Alaskans know, many of the films that have been made have taken similar liberties for similar reasons. with this country. It's a damn shame. Because if they would read the real stories, which are so much stranger than fiction, they would know they didn't have to invent anything. I mean, take the incredible story of the first discovery of gold in Bonanza Creek, a creek that I played on in my childhood. Take the characters of the people that were involved in that discovery and look at them and see what the gold did for them. No greater, it's so ironic and so strange and so weird that you couldn't put it in a novel. People would say it was unreal, but it was real, it happened. There you had a guy called George Washington Carmack, who had come up and become a squaw man, and who thought of himself as a native, as an Indian. He liked to be called a squaw man. He enjoyed that. He was married to an Indian wife named Kate, and he was a fisherman. An uncommonly sensitive man, in many ways. He had an organ in his cabin. He used to spout poetry and write it himself, quote Shakespeare. And miners didn't think much of him because he didn't care about gold, didn't care about mining. He was fishing at the mouth of the Klondike River without a thought in his head when Robert Henderson came along. Now here he had, on the other hand, Robert Henderson from Nova Scotia, who had, since the age of 13, spent his entire life obsessed by the idea of finding gold. He had sought it in Nova Scotia, he'd gone to New Zealand, Australia, Colorado, all the way up the Cordilleran spine of this continent into the BC gold camps, and finally into Alaska, and finally from Alaska all over the Yukon. And now he was coming to the Klondike River because he was convinced there was gold there, and he was, of course, right, as we know. And he stops and he meets Carmack, and he tells him that he's found some good prospects on Gold Bottom Creek, which he had named himself, which turned out later to be a very rich creek. And he asks, he suggests that Carmack go and look for gold. And Carmack doesn't want to look for gold. But after they've fished for salmon and Henderson is gone, they decide they'll go over and see what Henderson is doing. They go over and say hello to Henderson. And they want to borrow some tobacco. And Henderson then makes the greatest mistake of his life. He makes a racist remark. He says, Carmack, I'll lend you some tobacco, but I want you to give me those damn Siwashes. And this remark rankles. So Carmack, who still isn't looking for gold, is heading back, and Henderson says, incidentally, go back by way of Rabbit Creek and see if there's any gold there. I think there probably is. If there is, come on back and tell me. So they go back over the divide to Rabbit Creek, and while Carmack is lying on his back snoozing, Skookum Jim accidentally happens upon a piece of flaky bedrock, the rim rock at the edge of the creek, and in it there's quite clearly a great handful of gold. Apart from the fact that that isn't normally the way you find gold at all, this is probably the only place where that gold was, and they happened to hang on to it. There was the whole business of the non-prospectors finding the riches. Now, if Henderson hadn't made that remark about the Siwashes, certainly they would have gone back and told him. But they didn't. And Skookum Jim didn't want it. And that resulted in this bitter disappointment which dogged Henderson for the rest of his life. Off Carmack and the Indians go, stake the discovery claim on what then was called Bonanza Creek, and started the Klondike Gold Rush. Scores of men came up from 40 Mile and staked the whole of the Klondike Basin, while Henderson is still toiling away on Gold Bottom. He didn't even have a very good claim on that. And he looks up one day and sees these people coming over the ridge. He says, what's going on? They said, haven't you heard? Didn't anybody tell you? No. Well, I said, Carmack has struck it rich in Bonanza Creek. Now, Henderson had to sell his claim. He had impaled himself on a willow branch earlier that decade looking for gold on Quartz Creek. And this old injury came back, and to pay the medical bills, he had to sell that claim, which later, it was worth several, about $25,000, $30,000. He sold, I think, for $800. And that was stolen from him on the boat out to Seattle, and so was his gold watch. What more ironic story have you got than that? They never made a movie of it. And the sequel to it is equally ironic. Carmack, who all his life had wanted to be an Indian, once he got the gold, decided he wanted to be a white man, ditched his Indian wife, never saw her again, married a camp follower, and lived happily ever after, having, you know, done everything wrong. Tagus Charlie, who wanted to be treated like a white man, was treated like a white man. They allowed him to drink. And one day when he was drunk, he fell off a bridge and was drowned. Skookum Jim not content to be treated like a white man, wanted to be a white man, which meant he wanted to be a prospector. And though he was getting $90,000 a year in royalties from that first claim, he killed himself literally of exhaustion, tramping all over the Klondike Hills and the Yukon Hills trying to find another one, vainly. And Bob Henderson spent the rest of his life looking for a gold mine. And when he was dying of cancer in 1933, he was still talking about another, going once again, another stampede, wearing his old miner's hat to the end. When I was researching this book, I couldn't believe how truth can be stranger than fiction, because every story I hit seemed to have this kind of weird fictional twist to it. And I hadn't known that. I was raised, as you heard, in Dawson City. Born in White Horse, but when I was 2 months old, my father was mining recorder. Later on, moved to Dawson. And it didn't occur to me as a small boy, is it? Why should it? That I was really living in one of the weirdest and nuttiest towns in the world. A town that had been built to hold 30,000 people was still that size, and there's only 1,000 or 1,200 people living there. A town where the very streets literally glittered with gold. You could pan underneath any of the floors of any of the major buildings on Front Street, or indeed under the sidewalks, as the unemployed men did in the 30s, and find gold. When they took the floor up from the Bank of Commerce, they got somebody took a lay on the Bank of Commerce, and he got $3,500 out of it in a day. And the bank got half, 50% lay. I was telling Mr. Thompson how Harry Gleaves panned the floor of the old Orpheum Theater. He only had 3 hours. They're tearing up the floor, and they're going to put a new one down. So he decided to pan. He took out $1,500 in 3 hours. That gold, the town roared on gold. And when I was a boy, later on in my teens, and I worked there, the relics of this fantastic episode in our history, one of the greatest and most bizarre episodes in all of North American history, were all around me. The streets of Dawson were knee-deep in old mining machinery, half covered by willows and grasses. 6 steamboats sat rotting down at the old shipyard around the curve of the river. In the cabins of the miners were diaries of those days, which I'm afraid have long since vanished. I remember my father building a boat in an old hotel on Front Street, and I went in the back one day and I found a pile of letters this thick, tied with a lavender ribbon from a dance hall girl to her boyfriend in the creeks. Didn't have the sense enough then to save them. When I worked in the mining camps in Dominion Creek, and when we went up bonanzas on picnics, the paraphernalia of the gold rush was all around us. If there was one wheelbarrow resting in those flats, there were 10,000 of picks and shovels, as many as grains of sand on the slopes of El Dorado. Cabin after cabin, some of them still filled with loot. And the queerest devices you ever saw. I was walking up Dominion Creek one evening, and I turned a corner, and there in front of me was an enormous machine. It was the height of this room. It was set on 2 tracks. It was a mechanical digger, 3 stories high with a huge bucket line. Not like a dredge, which digs its own and floats on its own pond, but this was supposed to go along on this railway and churn up the ground. It had moved exactly 10 feet, and half the buckets were full, and the other half weren't and hadn't worked, and they left it. Around the next corner, giant scrapers, and the whole valley scraped clean and pulled across the valley on drag lines. Every kind of strange mining device. But it was years and years before I came to the realization that I had been raised under very interesting circumstances. The people were very interesting people. They weren't the average, you know, a town of 1,200 people. You don't find the kind of people you found in Dawson City. Oxford Dons, remittance men, guys who had gone up in 98 and never gone out again. The library was full of them. They're great readers, all of them. Mounted policemen, young men from England, younger sons of fabled families. These people were in my house, our house, all of my childhood. It only occurred to me later on in life when I was seriously researching this period But I suppose the worst thing that can happen to you in this life, worse than the sudden death of a friend or loved one, perhaps even, worse than a sudden illness, worse than any natural catastrophe, is to have sudden riches thrust upon you. If the Klondike tells us anything, it tells us that. Almost everybody who made it big died penniless. Charlie Anderson, the lucky Swede, bought a claim when he was drunk, tried to give it back, took $1 million of it, and his life pushing a wheelbarrow in a BC lumber camp. His story was repeated dozens and dozens and dozens of times. The attitude towards money or wealth or gold, whatever you want to call it in those days, was a very peculiar attitude because there was so much of it around. It became as nothing. Pat Galvin summarized it. His nephew talked about expense to him one day. Galvin, I think at that time, was about to buy, in fact, just had bought the steamer Yukoner from Willie Irving. It was in not very good condition because Irving, who was a spirited river boat captain from the Fraser, didn't dock his steamer in the normal way. He always charged at the dock at full speed. And just as he was about to reach the dock, he would order reverse, you see, and the whole boat would shudder to a stop and just graze the dock. But sometimes he charged one boat out here in Norton Sound and did full on with lamentable results. And after that, just to keep his hand, and he charged the dock and didn't turn the reverse on in time enough and reduced that to splinters. He was a very colorful guy. He used to, when they took on wood, he would arrive at each wood depot with an orchestra playing on the front, and all the girls out and dancing away, and he'd pour champagne for all the woodcutters. Anyway, he sold the Yukoner to Pat Galvin, who, when he bought it, gave everybody on board a $20 gold piece as a little gesture. And his Galvin's nephew mentioned the expense, and Galvin turned on him, and he said, and this is really the story of the Klondike, he said, "Expense, expense, I am disgusted with you. Don't show your ignorance by using that cheap outside word. We do not use it here. Never repeat it in my presence again. You must learn the ways of Alaska. That word is not understood in the North. If you have money, spend it. That's what it's for. That's the way we do business." He was offered $1 million for his holdings in Bonanza Creek. He turned them down and he died broke, but he never whimpered. I suppose that when everybody has several millions in the ground, and when those millions won't buy normal things, because there are no normal things around, everybody living in horrid cabins of green logs, you know, like Serbian peasants of the poorest kind, all potentially wealthy, I suppose that when that happens, you have to buy your status in a different way. And the way the Klondikers bought it during the gold rush in Dawson was by the grand gesture. I suppose the master of the grand gesture was the most engaging of all the Klondike rogues. That was Swiftwater Bill Gates. He's a little man about this, maybe higher than that, 5'4" he was. Very nondescript creature with a straggly black mustache. Nobody paid any attention to him at all until he struck it rich. And because he was potentially wealthy, they paid a great deal of attention. He always wore a Prince Albert coat. As a matter of fact, almost everybody dressed up as well as they could. We see in the movies everybody's wearing Mackinaws, but a lot of people were quite formally dressed in those days. Swiftwater Gates had the only starched collar in town, and he was so proud of it, he used to go to bed when it was being laundered. A great story about him, of which there are many versions. The great status symbol in Dawson was an egg. I remember my father telling me you couldn't get eggs. Eggs were $2 each if you could get them. Onions were sold in the drugstores. They were so valuable. Salt was literally sold for its weight in gold. Tells you something about the law of supply and demand. But anyway, Swiftwater, who was quite a ladies' man and liked them very young, was attempting to woo a girl named Gussie L'Amour, who he wanted to marry. And she wasn't having much to do with him, so she was eating in one of the cafes with a gambler, and she's very fond of eggs. And she ordered eggs, and Swiftwater went and he bought up all the eggs there were in town and had them fried one by one and fed to the dogs in front of Gussie L'Amour. And this more or less bought her to heel. She then promised to marry him, conveniently forgetting that she had a husband and a four-year-old child out in San Francisco. It didn't stop him. He went on to... He did all sorts of things. He didn't drink, but he bathed in champagne. In the Baldwin Hotel, I think in Seattle, he bathed in champagne. The bill for damages was $15,000. He used to hire bellboys to page him and all. He'd buy a lot of paging. He'd go in and give a bellboy a lot of money, and the bellboy would rush around the lobby of the hotel shouting, "Swiftwater Bill Gates, the king of the Klondike, is wanted." Well, I guess he got his money's worth. They all did things like this. When Arizona Charlie built the Palace Grand, which is the building they restored in Dawson in 1899, he invited 40 of the leading townspeople to come to a banquet, and he put a $100 bill under every plate. You don't get that kind of banquet anymore. Big Alec McDonald's attitude towards gold was that it was trash. At one point, he was worth $39.9 million in paper. He was a great big moose of a man. They called him the Big Moose from Antigonish, Nova Scotia. Great big ham-handed guy. But because he was, on paper, the wealthiest man in Dawson, he became a social lion. There was this incredible pair of tourists that came up the Yukon in 1898. And there were only two tourists in Dawson in 1898. The rest were all looking for gold. But these two buxom matrons, society women, you know, they went somewhere every year, Bath one year, Shanghai. They looked around, what's going on? Well, I think we should go to Dawson. There seems to be something interesting up there. So off they went. And they brought everything with them, trained parrots and a whole miniature bowling alley and several dogs and canaries and pigeons and the damnedest things. So one was the widow of an admiral, and it was a niece of a former president, a Mrs. Van Buren. And then they also bought a huge marquee tent, so big that the Salvation Army asked if they could borrow it for Sundays. In fact, it was so big it was cold inside, and they had to pitch a smaller tent inside to live in. And they also had an organ with them, which the Salvation Army was glad to use. The pigeons would keep landing on this organ, would start up again, they'd sing the same hymn over and over again as soon as it would start. But they looked around, being society women, who was the leader of the social set? And it was Big Alec McDonald. And they'd invite him to dinner, and he'd come in a boiled shirt, all dressed up, and they'd sit down, they'd have anchovies and mock turtle soup and scalloped tomatoes and roast moose and asparagus salad with French dressing and peach ice cream and French drip coffee, all of which they brought with them, too. So he had status for the first time in his life. Because he had $39 million, he was the man who always made the presentations, and they couldn't have chosen a worse man. He didn't know how to speak, you see. Well, Sam Steele, who was the superintendent of police, a great man indeed, when he left in 1899, they decided that they would have a ceremony in which they would get this huge poke of gold, which they would be raised by public subscription, and they would, Big Alec McDonald would present it to Sam, making a graceful little speech saying how the community had honored him and how he had kept the law in the Yukon, how wonderful he was, and they hoped he wished him well in his future and all this. And several speechwriters worked with Big Alec for a week on his speech. And they all clustered around the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Barracks, Northwest Mounted Police Barracks, and then they, as a special gesture, the steamboat came down to the front of the barracks. And here's Big Alec, you know, his hands were about four times my size, jutting out of this black suit, standing there, you see, holding this poke of gold. And finally somebody says, "Come on now, come on." And they push him forward, and he staggers forward, and he looks at Steele, who he knew very well, and he said, "Here, Sam, is a poke for you. Bye." And not content, but they still had let him be the social leader, because when Lady Minto, the Governor General, came in 1901, first Governor General in the North, you see, and so they had this beautiful thing for Lady Minto. They'd spent a lot of time. It was a golden bucket with a little windlass, and it was full of nuggets, and it all made perfectly. And once again, they got Big Alec to present it to her. He was supposed to make another speech, and all they said was, "Here, take it, it's trash." His attitude towards gold, he had a big bowl of nuggets on his mantelpiece, and he used to say to people, "Go help yourself. Take two, take big ones," he'd say. They're nothing to me. He died chopping wood in Clear Creek of a heart attack, dead broke. It's interesting what people, you see, here you had people who had never had any money at all, who had gone to the ends of the earth seeking it, who had very little education, and when they got it, had nothing to buy with it. A unique situation. So they really threw it away. Not for the sake of just throwing it away, but because the gesture of throwing it away was what counted. That's really what goes on today anyway. You know, people read. It's what Thorsten Veblen called conspicuous waste. The Veblen theory was never better tested than the Klondike, but it's tested in the Haida Indians do the same thing in potlatches, you know, where the chief, or if you want to raise, go higher in your totem, you throw a big potlatch and you give as many presents as you can. You destroy stuff in front of people. A lot of them used to build dance halls. They used to buy champagne in the dance halls. The status symbol was the private box. And you could only order champagne in the private box. And it was $30 a pint. One guy managed to order $1,700 worth of champagne in one night in a private box in the Monte Carlo. A lot of champagne, even at $30 a pint. Of course, he didn't drink it all himself. He had a couple of girls helping him. One guy called Roddy McDowell paid a dollar to have a dance, the long, dreamy, juicy waltz, which always lasted about 30 seconds, you see. And they thrust you out, and you paid another dollar, and you got another dance with these girls. But even at that, $50,000 is a lot of money to spend on dancing. And Roddy McDowell spent $50,000 on dancing, $1 a dance. And they had to work him in teams. He would exhaust these dance hall girls. And there were these two sisters called Jacqueline and Rosalind, better known as Vaseline and Glycerine. And they would dance with Roddy at a dollar a dance. Vaseline would dance for about six dances and exhaust it. She'd stagger out of the bar, you see, and immediately a Glycerine would move in and take him over so that he never stopped dancing. He'd dance all night, every night, till dawn, till $50,000, that's what he'd made, was gone. And then he stopped dancing, and so did they. Or maybe they kept on dancing. They had more reason than he did to dance. I wonder if you ever thought of the correlation between transportation and social status. Think about that. In the Roman days, it was the chariot and the horses that gave you status, and what you did to the chariot. It was the carriage and four later on, wasn't it? And the silver and the bridles, and the kind of carriage and footman. In the American Wild West, it was the horse and the saddle. The saddle is what gave you status. They had beautiful silver work on the saddles. Remember that? In the Yukon, and today, of course, it's the Cadillac, isn't it? Just as it was the private yacht in the 20s. Cadillac and the Rolls Royce came later. Always transportation is involved with status. In the Yukon, in the Gold Rush days, and in Alaska, it was the dog team. Social status, to a great extent, was determined by the quality of your dogs. Coatless Curly Monroe had six puppies, and he lavished on those puppies in a single season 4,320 pounds of bacon, fish, and flour at a dollar a pound. He was called Coatless Curly because he never wore a coat. Beautiful vests and beautiful shirts, and of course three suits of underwear, which he didn't tell anybody about, but no coat. And Nigger Jim Doherty, who was a white blonde southerner, called Nigger Jim because of his accent, had the finest, he had real status. He had eight matched dogs. They cost him $2,500, and he built a bar in his dog team. He had a blacksmith galvanize it, and was full of alcohol, which he kept heated. And he'd serve it to his friends in little tin cups. He'd drive along the dog team. He'd stop the dog team for a drink. A little sugar, a little water, a little alcohol. Thanks, Nigger Jim. They'd all drink. And that's a fine fellow, that Nigger Jim, you see. And he was. What people do with money, you see. Now, it's not really much different than what goes on with certain people today, does it? You think about that. That's what they had to do with their money. But it's still flung around. The gamblers threw money away too, but that was a different kind of a thing. They didn't really gamble for status reasons. They gambled because money was cheap and you could throw it in the gaming tables and think nothing of it. Harry Woolrich made $60,000 in a single game and decided that he'd keep it. He would quit gambling forever. And he went down to the boat and he was going to go outside, and all his friends were, they're gathering around him and cheering him on. And the boat was delayed half an hour. So Woolrich said, "I've got 50 cents left," he said. He walked across the Dominion gambling house and he threw it on the table. He said, "There's my goodbye to gambling, friends." And he lost. So he took another 50 cents out of his pocket automatically and threw that on. He lost that too. 24 hours later, he was still there. The boat had gone. He was down to his steamboat ticket. He threw that on the table and he lost that too. There was a night watchman for the White Pass Company called One-Eyed Riley. And he had his lunch hour was at midnight, which is a good time to gamble, especially as the M&N gambling houses kitty corner from the White Pass ticket office. And he used to go over there and play Faro Bank for an hour. And he'd win a little or lose a little, but one night he started to win at every turn of the card. So he just quit his job. He didn't go back. He just kept playing. And he played all night, and he kept winning in every turn of the card. And pretty soon, there's a huge crowd around him all playing on his card because he was winning. And he began to go from gambling house to gambling house. He's an enormous crowd following him, winning all the time. Till about 7 or 8 that morning at the Monte Carlo, they brought in a very experienced faro dealer to deal against him. And his winning streak finally came to an end. He had won $28,000. Now, he knew as a gambler that if he stayed in Dawson, he'd lose it all the next night. It was midwinter, and it was very tough to get out of Dawson in midwinter, but he hired a dog driver for $1,000 to take him to Skagway. And when he got to Skagway, some guy had some dice, and he lost $28,000 in 3 passes. Now, one of the things that interests me about all this is that there were certain people in this mad, goal-crazy arena who did not literally care about getting rich, who were not obsessed by conspicuous wealth or status or money or treasure. And it's interesting how many of those people really came out better in the end. I suppose the best one was William Ogilvie, the Canadian government surveyor. His job was to resurvey the claims that had been so badly laid out by the miners in the first rush to the Klondike, to Bonanza and El Dorado. And he had with him a mule skinner from Idaho named Dick Lowe. And Ogilvie would measure the claims, which are supposed to be 500 feet long. If they were longer than that, there was what is called a fraction or fractional claim, which anybody who hadn't used up his staking rights could stake. Dick Lowe, who was working for Ogilvie at the time as a chain man, hadn't found a piece of ground to stake. So Ogilvie said, "Look, here's a fraction of 86 feet. Why don't you stake that?" And Lowe said, "Why don't you?" And Ogilvie said, "I'm a government employee. I'm not permitted to stake, and I won't." He didn't. So Lowe said, "Well, it's too small. I want something bigger." And he looked all over, and he couldn't find anything. So finally, very reluctantly, he staked this little sliver of ground. And he tried to sell it for $900 the next day and didn't get any takers. So he sunk a shaft in it and didn't find anything. And he was going to give up, but he sunk another shaft just for the hell of it. And out of that second shaft, in 8 hours, he took $46,000 worth of gold. That was the Dick Lowe fraction. It's famous because it paid out $500,000 and was the richest single piece of ground in all the history of the world anywhere. And Dick Lowe, once he took out that money, got drunk. And he stayed drunk until all the money was gone. He pawned his watch finally in Victoria, and he ended up here in Fairbanks in 1905, peddling water by the bucket. He died broke in 1907. William Ogilvie, it's nice that there's a moral to this story, isn't it? Who was a very scrupulous and honest man, and who could have made his fortune over 1,000,000 times and never did because he felt as a government servant he couldn't take advantage of the knowledge that he had, lived to a ripe old age and many grandchildren, didn't know an unhappy moment in his life, and died happy. His granddaughter lives in Ottawa. She was up for the Gold Rush Festival in 62. There's another strange thing happened at the height of the Gold Rush. Very early, in 1897, Before the outside world knew about the gold rush, the inside world knew about it. All the Alaska miners knew about it, and they ran on the ground floor. That's when the fortunes were really made and lost. In the middle of all this crazy, heaving mass of humanity, all seeking for gold, there were two men who didn't care a hoot about it. One was a murderer on the run, and the other was a private detective hired to capture him. The murderer was a kid named Novak, a very dumb guy. He had killed a farmer and then burned down the building in the belief that the insurance company would think he was the farmer and then would pay out the insurance to him somehow. The insurance company went straight to the private detective agency and they hired a detective named Perrin. And by the time they reached the Klondike, Perrin had traveled 25,000 miles searching for Novak. And this is the sort of thing Hollywood didn't make, you see, and could have. He had to go, when he heard that Novak was heading for the Klondike, this was before the stampede. Novak didn't know about the stampede, neither did Perrin. He was just going to get as far away as he could from the police. So Perrin had to go all the way to Ottawa and get a deportation order so that when he caught up with Novak, he could get him out of Canada. They went back and he headed north. At one point, they were only a mile apart, both building boats on Lake Bennett and didn't know it. And they started, and at one point, the detective actually passed his quarry without knowing it and beat him into Dawson, you see. And so they reached Dawson, and there was fortunes to be made for everybody. But all that Novak was doing was hiding in a tent, and all that Perrin was doing was going from tent to tent looking for Novak. And finally, of course, he found him, put the arm on him, got on a boat, and took him out, and paid no attention whatsoever to the greatest gold rush in history. I've told you, as I told my producer friend in New York, that Dawson was not a violent town. It's quite true there wasn't a murder in 1898 or a theft. My father told me that you could leave your pack on the trail and come back in 2 weeks and be untouched. There was a New Zealander named Jim Dalziel. He used to go away at first. There were no keys in Dawson. In fact, as Mr. Thompson and I were reminiscing, there were no keys in the 30s when I stayed. In fact, in 48, when I stayed at the Royal Alexander Hotel in Dawson, there still wasn't a key for my room. The door was open. You could leave anything. Jim Dalziel used to leave his suit hanging on the side of his wall on a hook with a solid gold 18-carat watch hanging out of the pocket. When he came back a month later, it'd still be there. This is because of the Mounted Police. Nobody could pack a gun in Dawson City, in spite of all the movies which show them packing guns. Police confiscated so many revolvers, they auctioned them off as mantelpiece souvenirs. There were some heinous crimes. Chopping your wood on Sunday was one. One man was fined $3 for examining his fishnets on the Sabbath. The blue laws were always with us in Canada, and they were a feature of Dawson. They used to try to get around them in various ways. The theaters couldn't open on the gambling houses had to close, and the theaters had to close on Sunday, but the theaters used to have religious tableaus on Sundays, and they couldn't stop them having them with a silver collection. And, you know, and the curtains would part, and here would be a giant cross in the center of the stage, and this naked girl, Caprice, clinging to it like that. And then, of course, there was a Sunday excursion to Alaska, because the blue laws didn't operate on the other side of the border. And they used to have these wonderful excursions, which everybody would get on these boats, and the boats would go as hell-bent for another until they hit the border, and then they'd open up the booze, you see. One Sunday, the Bonanza King went across the border with 368 people on board, and the Tyrrell with 100. And the Bonanza King ran out of fuel, and the Tyrrell had engine trouble. And both these boats, loaded with the finest and most interesting people in Dawson, all of them gloriously drunk, floated into the very heart of Alaska, across the Arctic Circle, before they got them working again. And Bert Parker, who told me this story, said that he never saw Dawson. He said it was a morgue all that week. No gamblers, no dance hallers. It was terrible. He said when the boats came back, he said the whole town was on the Thursday. The whole town was down the docks to greet these rather bedraggled-looking people as they got off the boat. Well, that tells you something, you know. It's very interesting, this difference. A lot of my American friends say, you know, we're just like you, Canadians, but it's not true. There's quite a difference between Canadians and Americans. And it was exemplified in this international rush, where the rush and the stampede took place on both sides of the border. And I thought a lot about it, because you have to go into the history of both countries to see the difference in the personalities of the two countries, and the difference in the way laws are made, and the difference in the attitudes toward order, toward democracy, and so on. American experience is a revolutionary experience. It grows out of revolutionary action. It grows out of really illegal action, dumping the tea into the Boston Harbor and taking up arms against the king. Canadian experience is a colonial experience, which is quite different. It's in which there is, in which really order is superimposed from above by a constabulary and by a colonial government. American experience is where everything springs out of the grassroots. And this is especially true in the Yukon and Alaska. You had, on the Alaska side, a good deal of grassroots democracy in which people made their own laws. The device of the miners' meeting, which came from California, was one where the miners' meeting was the only law there was. And the miners' meeting acted as judge and as jury and as constabulary and as executioner. It could hang a man, and did. It could banish a man, which is the same as death. It could lash a man for theft or something. You had, over and over again in the stories on the Alaska side, you always have committees being formed. In the diaries, they're always forming a committee to do something. Now, on the Canadian side, you had a quite different tradition. The mining law throughout the Canadian mining camps, right up through British Columbia, was always the same, and it wasn't enforced by a grassroots democracy or by a committee or a vigilante group either. It was enforced by a court of justice, a British court. Usually the judges appointed, not elected, never elected in Canada, quite often from Britain, and by a constabulary, which in the Yukon was, of course, the Northwest Mounted Police. And there's a lot to be said on both sides of this. On one side, you had freedom, which in its worst aspects was anarchy. On the other side, you had order, which in its extreme was dictatorship. I suppose there's no better example than the difference that you saw on both sides of the border of the White Pass. On one side, you had Samuel B. Steele sitting up there like a great godlike figure looking down on this groaning, I mean, it's really allegorical, this scene up the White Pass, these people bent double in this long chain of people groaning under these packs. It's almost like Dante's Inferno when it's from his eyrie up the Iron Man looking down, protecting them all, you see. Once in a while, some malcontent would come across the border and Steele would send him back, just like that. Now, and this is the place where you really could lay your pack on the ground and it would never be stolen. People did this. They had to, because they had to take a ton of goods over the Chilkoot and the White Pass, and you couldn't take them in one thing. You had to, you know, 60 pounds is about all a man could carry. And 60 pounds divided into 2,000 means how many trips? About 30 trips or 35 trips, you see. So what you did is you climbed up, and when you hit the border, the Mounties checked you through, and you put down your stuff, and you went back for more, and nobody dared steal it. Now in Skagway, Alaska, Samuel Steele described it as a hell on earth, and with good reason. He went down there, he was passing through one day, and he tried to get some sleep, and he couldn't because the bullets are coming through the top of the log cabin he was in. They're shooting every night. This was the town that was run by Soapy Smith. At its worst, this committee idea, this vigilante idea of running things at its extreme is dangerous because one man can take over. That's what happened in Skagway. Jefferson Randolph Smith was a very cool customer, took over in the way that European dictators later took over. He ran everything. He suborned the press. That's the first thing he did, was buy the newspapermen. They're the cheapest, with all due respect to the journalism class at the University of Fairbanks. Easier to buy journalists than politicians, even. That's not hard. Then he bought the politicians, and he bought the judge and the marshal and everybody else. And the businessmen, of course, he didn't have to buy them. They thought he was a great guy. Businessmen often do think that about dictators. He was bringing business to town. He had a telegraph office. You could send a wire, and he'd guarantee you an answer in 3 hours. It always came collect. Now, the interesting thing is, of course, there was no telegraph wires going to Skagway at all. There was just this tent. And when the Spanish-American War came up, he had a recruiting office. It was great because you had to take your clothes off for the physical examination. When you got them back, there wasn't anything left in the pockets. They had every device in the world, including... They even had dummy sleds for these con men to pull up the pass. And they were just wire frames full of feathers, you see, lettuce, anything, but they had axes sticking out of them, apparently sacks of food and everything else. They used to have people disguised as newcomers, you know, saying, helping to carry the bags of men who would arrive off the boat and take them up to the reliable packers, who were the most unreliable of all packers. They packed everything away, but you never saw it again, you know. Now, the interesting thing is, the American temperament is such that the American does not like order from above, I don't think. I think historically this is true. He resists this kind of thing. So he can only be pushed so far. The Americans did not like the mounted police telling them what to do, even when the mounted police were engaged in forcing them to, the Americans to save their own lives. Americans all wanted to take their boats to the Miles Canyon and the White Earth Rapids, and about 150 of them drowned before Stanham Steele came along and said, I'm not going to let you do this anymore. We can't have people drowning in Canadian soil. You all have to get out of your boats, and we'll send Mounties through with your boats, and you walk around the side. And well, there was a huge fuss. How dare you tell us what we're going to do? You see? And then he said, you'd have to check in on the river so we can make sure that you're not drowned halfway down there again. Well, and if you don't check in soon enough, we'll send us somebody to look for you. Well, this was rankled with the Americans. They didn't like that. They were not used to this kind of, you know, dictatorship, which is what it was. But finally, they didn't like Sophie Smith either, you see, because he was beginning to act like that, and not in their interest at all. And so they took what was the traditional frontier United States method of handling the thing. They formed a committee, and they shot Sophie Smith. I mean, they probably would have shot him anyway, but he tried to break up the meeting, and they just, one guy, Frank Reed, shot him. As you know, if you've been through Skagway, you cannot miss that story, because he is the greatest asset Skagway ever had. I don't know what they'd do without him. When I was writing this book,